supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have one of those jam-packed shows for you today, Cats and Kittens. Later on, our good friend Lee Reich will join us to talk about underutilized fruits. Fabulous fruits that you should be growing and probably aren't. When we get to the question of the week, we will reveal that, yes, Virginia, there is actually a good wood mulch if you use it correctly. Before that, though, lots of your correct phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Mark. Where are you, sir?
I am in Idaho Falls, Idaho.
Excellent. Excellent. What can we do for you, Mark?
So I have a question about transplanting a rhubarb plant. My sister got one last year. It didn't survive. A friend of mine had two huge plants that had died back. Mm-hmm. And we dug one up about a week and a half ago, and I replanted it. And I'm wondering if I had done it too late in the season.
Well, what difference does it make, Mark? You've done it, right?
Right. Well, yeah, right. Exactly.
The plants that were dug up, how old were they? You said they were big plants.
It was a big root ball, probably about a year, 2 years old.
Oh, so that's just a baby, though.
Well, yeah. The ball itself probably weighed about 30, 35 pounds with the, you know, little dirt that was around it. So it was pretty heavy, pretty big.
Okay, good, good. Ideally, you know, because you don't need me to tell you that you're in a cool climate. Ideally, you would have done this back in September. That would be the best time.
Okay.
But you never know what's going to happen. For instance, there is nothing more you should do unless you have access to a time machine. We're just going to watch and see what happens. But in the future, fall meaning in your area anytime from mid-August through mid-September, is not only the ideal time to transplant or plant new stands of rhubarb, but when a rhubarb plant has been in the same place for about 5 years, it starts to be non-productive and actually needs to be dug up and divided.
Gotcha.
So late August through mid-September is the ideal time to do anything with rhubarb, whether you're moving it, dividing it, or planting it fresh.
Okay. Well, we've had unusually warm weather. It's still been in the upper 50s, lower 60s. At this point, should I cover it with any type of leaves or anything to keep it sheltered from the cold weather, frost, or just kind of cross my fingers and hope it survives?
Did you fill the hole with well-rotted manure or anything like that?
No, we did not.
Okay, because rhubarb is a heavy feeder. It is one of the plants that really does enjoy composted horse manure.
Okay.
So keep that in mind in the future. If we get good growth in the spring, you want to find some composted horse manure and spread it around the plant. It'll get to the roots that way on the surface of the soil. And if you want to mulch the plant to protect it this winter, just realize what you're protecting it from. You can't keep the soil warm. That's beyond our human capacity. What you can do is you can prevent the soil from heaving and thawing when we have freezing and thawing, and sometimes new plants can get pushed right up out of the soil. So yes, covering it with a couple of inches of leaves would be great, but the leaves must be shredded.
Okay.
You can't use whole leaves because that would be like throwing a tarp over the plant.
Okay.
And one little known fact of mulching, and this is really a good time to remind our listeners of it, the best time to mulch for winter protection is right after the soil freezes hard for the season.
Oh, okay.
Not while, nobody knows that, do they?
No, I didn't know that.
You don't want to mulch the soil when it's warm because you could arbitrarily keep the soil warm later in the season and interfere with dormancy. But once the soil is frozen solid, that's when you cover it with shredded leaves to insulate it and kind of keep it at that even temperature and not being warmed up by the sun or frozen on a cold day. But you want to start when the soil is frozen solid.
Okay, well, that's good information. I thank you very much.
All right, good luck, Mark. We hope you get some rhubarb in the spring.
Me too, thank you.
All right, take care, man.
You too, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Donna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I love your program. I listen to it whenever I can.
Very good. Where are you?
I'm in central PA, outside of Gettysburg.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very nice area. I did a talk at the Gettysburg Extension office there. Have you been there?
Oh, yeah. They're good pals of mine.
Oh, they're the best. And the office, because it's shaped like it has that silo-like structure. It's almost like a faux farm and everything. What a great place that was.
So now that we're here in central Pennsylvania, I have been lulled into growing dahlias. And I grow them for competition. So far, I've done pretty good. This year was kind of a challenge. But anyway, I keep trying to amend the soil. I find that the soil has a lot of clay in it.
Right.
So to amend it, what I've done so far is getting new soil and bringing it in with a mixture of some sand in it and putting that on top of my original soil and going higher. And then this year I tried mushroom soil. Wasn't so crazy about that. I find that very drying. But anyway, do you have any ideas for me with this?
Well, you're talking dahlias, so you lift the roots and store them inside during the winter.
I do, yes. Okay. We have to do that.
Have you considered growing them in containers during the summer?
I thought that I bring them in, and in March I start putting them in containers. And then they start, and then as the time goes on in May, once we're warm enough, I put them into the ground.
Okay.
And then I'm okay, yeah. But again, it's just a challenge because they're topsoil. The top, the root goes, right? And they're not going deep for their water.
Oh, no. Most garden soils are relatively poor quality, and dahlias do very well. When I've grown them in the past, I've only grown them in big containers and hanging baskets, and they've always grown brilliantly. Why do you feel the need to take them out of their container and put...
Because the plant grows to about 5 or 8 feet tall. We keep pinching them back, and I play with debudding them.
Right.
So I'm able to get a bloom that I can compete with then.
Okay. And what kind of sun are they getting?
Full sun. Well, actually, the sun comes later in the afternoon. Maybe about noon, I've got full sun in the backyard.
Okay. So they're getting some relief during the day. Are you feeding them?
Yes. Uh-huh.
What do you...
I don't remember the mixture right now, 520 or 5. The second number is the highest number that I try to get.
Oh, no wonder you're having problems because you're salting your soil.
Yeah.
You know, these chemical fertilizers don't exist in the natural world, Donna.
I know.
You know,
I know.
And dahlias are tropical plants. And one thing you probably know, although you haven't put it together, and tropical plants tend to grow in very nutrient-poor soils. So exposing them to these concentrated chemical salts dries them out and causes all kinds of problems. What I would do is I would make a good, true raised bed. Get in there and till it all up or double dig it out. If you're going to add anything at that point for good drainage, for improved drainage, not sand. Sand can be treacherous when you start mixing it with clay. You can accidentally make concrete that way. But I would mix in a big bag of perlite if you wanted to lighten up the soil. And then after your dahlia roots were in the ground, I would give them a nice 2-inch mulch of yard waste compost. Not mushroom soil, as you found out. Mushroom soil can be kind of harsh on its own. Some of its nutrients are very strong. The pH can be off. It can also be full of salts because they use a lot of horse manure in it. And the horses often have salt licks around them. So yeah. I would say a nice raised bed to which you've added a lot of perlite and then compost on the surface of the soil will probably give you your absolute best results.
Okay, is that like leaf mulch?
Shredded leaf mulch would be good. Now, when you shred up all your leaves this fall and you make a big pile of them, the material on the top that still looks like shredded leaves, that makes a great mulch for a garden bed, especially if you seem to have issues with watering, because it'll keep the surface of the soil cool and moist and earthworms will move in. The compost is the black dirt-like material that forms at the very bottom of the pile.
Right.
But both are good. Compost, shredded leaves. But I think if you stop using this chemical fertilizer, you're going to look better.
Lovely. Thank you.
Okay, so good luck with your dahlias, Donna.
Yes.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the 2017 You Bet Your Garden World Tour kicks off with me appearing in Fayetteville on Saturday, March 25th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with favorite forgotten fruits, the wood what works, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Is it possible that there is a type of wood mulch that is actually good for your plants? Yes, Virginia, there is. And it's doubly good for the environment, even. We'll tell you all about it and how to use it correctly. We'll also take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our very special guest with an open invitation anytime he's in town, Dr. Lee Reich, who is author of the pruning book, Grow Fruit Naturally, Landscaping with Fruits, and I guess your first book, certainly the first one that I was exposed to and our topic for today, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden. As always, Dr. Lee Reich, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Good to be here again.
We are taping this interview back in October. You're appearing at the Horticultural Society here in Philly tonight, giving a lecture on uncommon fruits. We're talking about underutilized fruits. I know you're a fan of currants and gooseberries. So what is your favorite fruit that you would consider uncommon, that you don't see growing in as many gardens as you think it should be?
Oh, that's a tough one because there's a lot of...
They're going to get harder.
A lot of fruits that I like. But I would say European black currant.
Oh, okay. My wife and I had an interesting currant experience recently. I was looking for a red fruit to celebrate our anniversary or something like that. And, you know, I grow tons of raspberries, so that was kind of out of the picture. But I was in Whole Foods, and they had what looked like beautiful red currants packaged up. And I don't think we'd ever eaten them, Lee. And I brought them home, and they were absolutely delicious. These were beautiful, delicate little round fruits with very thin stems. Now, are the black currants the same looking, except for the color?
They don't come in those long strigs like red currants, and they have a totally different taste. They have a very strong taste that fresh, not everyone likes them, admittedly. Made into cassis, the liqueur, or made into a jam, everybody likes them. I think they make a really good combination with dark chocolate, which I also happen to love.
Well, what doesn't make a good... I mean, bacon, come on, anything with dark chocolate.
True.
That's almost unfair. But I can see how that would work out. Now, you don't make any of your own liqueurs, do you?
I tried to make cassis once with my black currants, and it tasted like cough medicine. So I count that as a failure.
And I know in the back of my head there's something with currants and a disease crossover. And I think in the past you've told me that was either a mistake or overstated.
Both. So there was this. The genus Ribes, which includes currants and gooseberries, are an alternate host, susceptible ones of that genus, are an alternate host for white pine blister rust. So white pines were such an important timber crop that when this disease was introduced about 100 years ago, basically all ribes were banned. And that was a federal ban. The government would come and rip them out of your garden. And the ban was lifted in the 1960s and put under state mandate for various reasons, one being that the ban wasn't all that effective because, first of all, they're not all that susceptible. Not all species are. And there's a lot of wild ones, and under good conditions, the spores can travel hundreds of miles. So it was put under state mandate. Now many, many states, the majority of the states, I believe, have lifted the mandate, so basically everyone can plant. And in addition, there were some immune and resistant varieties developed. So now, you know, pretty much everyone can grow black currants.
And does that include you?
I've grown them for decades.
Legally?
Legally, and probably I would grow them illegally if I had to.
So tell us a little bit about them. What's their habit compared to that of, say, a blackberry or a raspberry?
So it's a shrub that grows maybe 3 feet high, 3 feet wide, bears its best fruit on one-year-old and less so on two-year-old wood, very deer-resistant.
Our ears just perked up.
Right. Deer-resistant. I didn't say deer immune. Deer-resistant.
Deer will eat the siding off your house after they finished off your garden.
And it's also another plus that most fruits can't do is they're very shade-tolerant.
So, all right. So, what's next on your uncommonly good list that isn't?
I would say possibly hardy kiwi fruit.
You know, we don't talk about that a lot on the show, but back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we would get a lot of mail about hardy kiwis.
So, why aren't you talking about it?
Well, we are now.
Oh.
So, the kiwis we see in the supermarket, they are from tropical climates or warm climates?
Subtropical. Right, and they differ, you know, they're large, fuzzy fruits. The hardy kiwi fruit's grape size, has a smooth skin, so you just eat them whole like grape. And, of course, they're hardy, so you can grow them into zone 3 or zone 4. And the thing is, they taste better. They taste very similar but better. Basically, everybody who tastes it agrees that this tastes better than the large, fuzzy kiwi.
Okay, so we're talking about a vine, It's got that name. So.
And you need separate male to pollinate or to sire up to 8 females.
Okay. So, and, you know, this is where a lot of people go south when they hear they have to have a different pollinator to get fruit, or like with holly to get berries.
Right. Well, on the plus side, though, the kiwi is a very ornamental plant. It was actually introduced into this country as an ornamental. And the hardy kiwis, people didn't even realize that there was fruit to be eaten, because it's not all that obvious on the plant, for decades after it was planted. And as is common with humans, the males are prettier than the females.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And birds. Don't forget birds. Right.
Right. Most, so, as true with most animals.
So in other words, you might, if you had the right kind of thing that you wanted to cover up, or an arbor that this would work on, you might just grow a male for the show of it.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to a lot of old estates like Dumbarton Oaks down in Washington, Old Westbury Gardens in New York, these, you see these vines planted, and they were not planted for their fruit. They were planted just as ornamental vines.
Do they need help? Are they self-clinging? Because I'm thinking if somebody had something like a chain link fence, that this vine would have no trouble finding stuff to grab onto all the time.
That's true, but you would have to, for fruit production, you'd have to be a little deliberate in, you know, where you cut and when you cut and how much you cut.
And then does it have any fall color?
No.
Do the leaves fall off in the fall?
They do fall off, but not with color. So the other kiwi, the Colomicta with the variegated leaves, that one actually bears very quickly. I've actually taken cuttings from them, and the cuttings the year after I take them have flowers on them.
And so you're literally just out there eating them?
Yeah.
As they ripen. And when do they ripen up?
Well, the Colomicta, which is the less rampant one that bears earlier with the variegated leaves, those bear in early August. And the other ones bear in September.
Okay. So those are good times of years to get some eaten.
Yeah, I think they're great fruits, and the flavor. I mean, I've had a lot of people taste them in my garden, and they just go crazy over them.
Spit seeds out? I mean,
no. Just no seeds? Little, you know, just like a large kiwi fruit, just those, you know, the fuzzy kiwi fruit, just little seeds that you eat.
Okay. That you eat?
Yeah.
Yeah, clean you out. All right, one last one. What's next on your?
I would probably say gooseberries,
because gooseberries are really curious looking.
Yeah, they really vary in how they look too. People always think a lot of people think who aren't familiar with gooseberries that all gooseberries are small, green, and tart, but there's large, relatively large fruits, almost plum sized gooseberries. There's red ones. There's spiny ones. You can eat not soft spiny ones. And the flavor also varies quite a bit from variety to variety. I mean, some of the best ones taste sort of plum-like or apricot-like, and some taste grape-like.
And where do these come from?
Well, they're hybrids. They're American species and there's European species, and they've been hybridized. The best ones, I have to say, are from Europe, except that they're also the most disease-susceptible ones. There's a disease called powdery mildew.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That, well, it's a special one of gooseberries that originated. It's American powdery mildew, and the European ones aren't resistant to that. But there's a lot of really good-tasting American varieties that are resistant.
And so what do you grow?
I actually grow the American varieties just because, except for one Finnish variety. There's one variety from Finland called Hinomakis Yellow, which has a great flavor, and it's disease-resistant.
And so tell us about the habit of a gooseberry. Is it similar to a currant?
Pretty much the same, except they have thorns. And there are a few...
So does that make it even more deer-resistant?
No, deer don't care about thorns.
No?
But they are deer-resistant. Mm-hmm. The whole genus is deer-resistant, and they're also shade-resistant. And there are a couple of varieties that are thornless. One is called spine-free. Which is not worth eating because it is thornless, but it's the berries are small, tough and tart.
Too much of a trade off, huh?
Yeah, but there's another variety called a Captivator from Canada, where gooseberries and currants were never banned, and it's excellent flavor and it is pretty much spine free, free of thorns.
So if you have shade and deer, it sounds like we're coming back to currants and gooseberries, and pretty easy to grow, pretty unusual. Amaze your friends, astound your neighbors, right?
And get good tasting fruit.
When do the gooseberries come in?
July.
Okay, so that's, again, great timing, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, once again, we have been speaking with Dr. Lee Reich, author of many books, including the pruning book, Grow Fruit Naturally, Landscaping with Fruits, and our topic for today, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, which is back in print in a relatively new edition. I'd say new to me because I've been around so long, from Timber Press. Lee, it's always a pleasure to have you back on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kirk, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am just ducky, Kirk. Thank you for asking, sir. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm in Logan Township, New Jersey.
Okay, Logan Township.
That's by Swedesboro, exit 10-295.
Okay, there you go. What exit? That's always the question for Jersey.
There we go.
Very good. What can we do for Kirk in the Garden State?
I have a brown turkey fig tree that I bought last year, and I gave it to my mom. We're Italian, Sicilian. And she kept it, and she really didn't want it. And they wrapped it over the winter, and she basically gave it back to me about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's almost 4 foot high. It's in a pot, which is like 15 inches round. The leaves are okay. It didn't produce any fruit that I am aware of, but last year it did have some fruit on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just debating whether should I put this in the ground now, this time, because we did have a frost here the other day on the roofs, but I don't think it was that sufficient. We had a couple of frost warnings, but this next week we're looking at rain on and off and nothing really below the mid-30s.
Right. With figs, the line is it's perfectly okay to wait to start protecting them and to also bring them out of their protection a little early. They just need to be protected from the absolute worst of winter. So you intend to plant it long term in the ground?
I was thinking I bought the house back in August. And the previous owners left three apple trees and two peach trees, which really don't look too healthy
right
now. And they were supposed to come back and take them to their new residence, but I haven't heard from them in a bit. So I figured the soil's pretty good, and I might be able to put it out in the garden. There's also an area where there was a flower bed, and there's some other type of trees and a rose bush, where it would be protected from the winds. And I have one of those 8-foot-high vinyl fences that it's solid. So we're not expecting any major gusts of wind, but I've never been here through the winter. So I would just be worried about it getting messed up during the wintertime. But my mom had looked at it and said, if you put it in that area, it would be fine. But my question is, should I put it in now? Am I okay? Or should I wait till next year?
Okay, so you do have a protected area for it.
Basically,
but
yes.
But it's got to be open on one side so it'll get sun in the...
Oh, plenty of sun in that area. It's just that it's like in an L shape of the house, mm-hmm. and it's in a nice area where it's not going to get like... It's not like an open field is what I'm trying to describe.
Your choices are to take it out of its pot, plant it in the ground in this protected area, but then I would also like put up a kind of a wall of burlap across the open area as well. Not so much wrap the plant, but break the wind from the other direction as well. Your other option is if you have an unheated garage that stays around like 40 degrees.
Which I do.
You could just roll that sucker in there and not have to do anything this winter. Leave it out until around December. And then just roll it into the garage. You can leave it on its side, or you can water it once and leave it standing up. But don't put it in a warm spot or give it any kind of light or water. And then in the spring, when the first things outside start greening up, you can move it back outside and either plant it or continue to have it in its pot. Your third option would be to dig a little trench in the ground, actually lay the plant sideways in the trench, and then cover it with shredded leaves for the winter. Any one of those is going to work for you.
That'd be great. Now, the other quick question, when I dig the hole, it's saying to – I still have the original tag, and it said to dig the hole twice as wide and as deep as the pot. remove the root ball and place it in the hole so the top is even with the ground surface, refill half soil and with the half native soil and water thoroughly, fertilize upon planting, and three layers of mulch. Well, the things that scare me there is
mulch, it's nonsense.
And fertilizer,
yeah. Yeah.
I always hear you about mulch.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. You definitely want to dig a wide hole, but not a deep one. You want it to be at least as high as it is in the pot, perhaps higher. You want to refill it only with your native soil, no other amendments. And if you want to mulch, you would mulch with something really natural, like shredded leaves or arborist wood chips. You'd start a couple of inches away from the base of the plant, and then you'd go out as far as the furthest branch. Really, all it needs is, once it gets put in the ground, is burlap not wrapped around the tree, just, you know, making a kind of a wall, a little house for it to live in. And then when the winter's over and it starts greening up again, give the plant a haircut. Get rid of any winter damaged areas, but do a little trimming all around to stimulate growth. And it sounds like you're in a perfect position to get figs.
Okay.
Never fertilize anything in the fall. They're insane.
I know. That's why I'm going to let it sleep over the winter, and I prefer the spring this way. Nothing harsh will happen, and I think I'll stand a better chance.
Yeah, I think you got great chance.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Mike. Love your show.
All right. Thank you, Kirk. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the 2017 You Bet Your Garden World Tour will continue with me appearing in State College, PA, April 6th through the 8th, or thereabouts. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Wood That Works and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Is there a type of wood mulch that's actually good to use in the landscape? The answer is yes. I'll tell you that right away, if you use it correctly. We'll provide all the details after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for taking the call, Mike.
Well, thank you for making it, Steve. Otherwise, I'd just be sitting here for an hour. Where are you, man?
I am in Spinnerstown, Pennsylvania.
I know Spinnerstown. I have sat at the bar of the Spinnerstown Hotel, in fact.
Yeah, it's one of those pass-through towns, but some of us live here.
Yeah, no, well, everybody's got to live someplace. Spinnerstown is like halfway between Quakertown and the Lehigh Valley. Nice little area, still very rural there.
Yeah, I'm on a farm.
Oh, there you go, see?
I've got sheep and goats, and my question is related to their fecal output.
Yeah, well, you've got good manure.
Yeah, that's what I think, but it's a question of timing. So I've got the center stall in my barn is packed with probably 3 to 4 year old stuff, and I've been mining it with a pickaxe and digging it out and putting a big pile in the garden. And the other day I thought, hey, I've got a lot of fruit trees, some young ones, some mature ones. Why don't I ring the fruit trees with this well-rotted manure and let it sit there over the course of the winter? My question is, I've always said, like, don't feed them in the fall, but
yeah.
Is it okay to let the snow and rain slowly let this stuff seep down into the soil, or should I hold back until spring to put it there?
Yeah, because the roots, it'll seep down, but there's no root action to take it up. You'll just lose nutrients. Now, this is very unusual because, you know, most people are talking about horse or chicken manure, and those materials are too hot to use on fruiting plants generally, especially fruit trees. If you use a high nitrogen fertilizer on fruit trees like apples and peaches, you'll actually cause defacing of the fruits. They don't like a lot of nitrogen. But I remember back from my days as editor of Organic Gardening magazine, one of the most fun articles we did, which will show you what kind of people we were, is we had every type of barnyard animal manure analyzed for nutrient content. And the results were very surprising. Sheep kind of came out as like the absolute best. Relatively good amounts of all the different nutrients, but in a very good balance. Now, what are you using as bedding?
Just oat straw. It's, you know, they bet on oat straw, but it gets packed down pretty quick. I've got about 7 sheep, and I'm thinking down to about 5 sheep and 7 goats.
And I think goat manure is pretty close to sheep manure in composition and stuff. So what I would do is just keep turning it, keep it in kind of a protected area, and in the spring, after the trees start growing again, when they flower, then you can apply a light mulch of this material around them. Just make sure it's completely composted, which I think is a little difficult with sheep manure because it's kind of pelletized.
This stuff is, because this has been packed down by their little hammer feet over the years, and I've actually had to dig it out with a pickaxe.
And you don't have anything like a chipper shredder, do you?
Well, I've got a tractor with a big bush hog on it. I'm thinking of just taking that to it.
Well, you know, in the old days, there was actually a machine called a soil mixer, and it was just a giant metal box with shaky, shaky parts in it, and you would put kind of compacted stuff like this in the top, and it would break it up into nice soil-like particles. Now, a modern chipper shredder, as made famous in the movie Fargo, would do the same thing. You would put this material into the hopper, and it would get busted up. So, you know, where you are, I would not be surprised if you didn't have a neighbor with a chipper shredder or something like that.
You can rent one up the road, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that would be my advice to you, is before you apply the material, bust it up a little bit, make it more like soil, and then just make it a 1-inch mulch around the base of the fruit trees, and of course not touching the actual trees.
Right. By putting it out there now, which I've done on a couple of trees before calling, am I doing any harm or just wasting the goodness?
Yeah, you're just wasting the goodness.
Okay.
You're throwing money away.
Well, I've got more goodness than I can handle. I've got plenty of goodness. Thanks for your advice.
All right, Steve. Good luck, sir.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Joan. How are you?
Well, it's cooling off here about 25 miles south of the Kansas border in northeastern Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Are you near Tulsa?
Yeah, between the Kansas border and Tulsa.
Okay, very good. I had such a great time in Tulsa. I was asked to come out and give a talk at a big gardening center that was opening, and I wondered if there were any gardeners in the Tulsa region. And boy, were there. You are very passionate about your horticulture.
You can say that again.
Well, I won't because it would take up too much time. Now, what can we do for Joan in Tulsa or near Tulsa?
All right. This is a he said, she said, and as the same issue arose twice or three times in the same day, we're appealing to the final arbiter of the court of Mike McGrath.
Okay. Very good.
We know better than to do any cuttings at this time of year, no pruning at this time of year. However, we donated a bunch of house plants to a courthouse and a library, and on the same day, we went to the big box store and stocked up on all of their 10-cent perennials, and on the same day, we noticed the beautiful tender perennials in another library bed maintained by the master gardeners, and he said, oh boy, let us save all these broken pieces from our donated plants and from the big box bargains, and let's take some of those tender perennial cuttings that we like from the salvia and sage in front of the library. And I said, oh, silly, they won't root at this time of year. So anyway, we went ahead with the broken pieces from these three situations, and sure enough, they're looking all wilty. And I thought, well, I wonder if it really is possible to do that in fall, to save broken pieces or to take tender perennial cuttings to overwinter in the house.
Well, I'm not quite sure about the, quote, tender perennial cuttings. But when you're talking about hardwood plants, yes, there is a technique where you do take the cuttings in the fall or ideally, as you said, the cuttings simply make themselves available without you doing any kind of pruning in the fall. And it really applies to any kind of plants that can be propagated, but we call it hardwood cuttings because in the fall, the wood is as hard as it's going to get, whereby in the spring, you know, it's very soft, the new growth. That's when you take softwood cuttings. But there are a lot of people who like to propagate what are called hardwood cuttings. And it sounds so ridiculous, but what you do is you take all of the cuttings from a specific type of plant, you tie them up with like a string, you soak them, you know, until they're really saturated with water, and then you bury them like 6 inches deep in the ground, and obviously you mark the area well, and you dig them up in the spring, and they may already be showing signs of new growth, or they are kind of prepped to be super softwood cuttings that are going to respond very strongly to the correct propagation techniques at that time of year.
Okay. I noticed that the leaves that are looking wilted, should they be removed to reduce the transpiration of water out of the plant?
Well, what are you doing to them? Do you have them sitting in, like, jars of water? Do you have them in little propagation tents?
Well, we have them in very, very moist soil in the sunny room in the house.
It might be too much water.
Okay.
Typically, what I would suggest when people are going to try to root something like a begonia, let's say, is to fill a pot with good drainage, a plastic pot, with the lightest, loosest seed-starting soil-free mix you can find, maybe with some extra perlite in it. Really saturate that water. Use a pencil to move some of the soil to the side. Drop the cutting in. Cover it back up again. Just go crazy misting it. And then put some chopsticks or something in the pot and put a plastic bag, a supermarket produce bag, over top of that. And keep it out of direct sun. And if you have any sense that it's getting dry in there, water it again, mist it again. But, you know, if you get wilting in that case, it just means the cutting didn't make it.
I guess he wins this one then.
All right, Joan. Everybody's a winner when the plants survive.
You can say that again. Oh, don't. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Okay, take care. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Yes, Virginia, there is a good wood mulch. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, you got two questions to start us off with this week.
I sure do, Mike. Ted Nadisto Island, South Carolina writes, "We had several large trees go down during Hurricane Matthew, and we spread the resulting wood chips in an island in the middle of our driveway that contains palmetto trees and a large magnolia. Was that okay? And do we need to routinely treat the area with a fungicide and high nitrogen fertilizer to offset the potential nitrogen robbing and fungus producing qualities of the wood chips?" We also heard from Tom in New Britain, PA, who wrote, "I recently came across a 2007 article from Washington State University that seems to refute much of what you've said about the dangers of using wood mulch. Now I'm confused. Care to comment?"
Well, there's no need for confusion or refutation, Tom. Now, that article was written by a good friend of the show, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott.
Oh my gosh, the author of How Plants Work. When you interviewed her a few years ago, the two of you agreed on everything about mulch and were both denouncing the improper mulching of trees. You were practically finishing each other's sentences. What could possibly be in her article that, quote, refutes your wood mulch warnings?
As it turns out, absolutely nothing. And we should note here that her article is only about, quote, the documented benefits and drawbacks of arborist wood chips as a landscape mulch.
Arborist wood chips, like from a tree trimming service, right? You've said that they're perfect to use in places like the lanes between raised beds and as a mulch around young trees and shrubs to prevent weeds and retain soil moisture, if they're used correctly.
Right. My absolute biggest beef is with these terrible dyed wood mulches, which can contain chipped up pallets from overseas that were soaked in insecticides to try and prevent the spread of invasive insects, and old school arsenic pressure treated wood, especially after a tornado or hurricane rips through an area and all the debris gets hauled to one of these chipping plants.
So our listeners in South Carolina would have been at serious risk of getting contaminated mulch if they had bought dyed stuff in bags or bulk after their hurricane. But they used material from their own fallen trees.
Yeah, and it occurs to me that arborist wood chips from your own property are doubly kosher because they don't need to be transported, thus making a carbon footprint the size of a baby shoe. But our listeners did unfortunately use this excellent material incorrectly, which we know because the photo they sent shows us that the mulch is piled right up against the trunks of their trees.
The dreaded volcano mulching. I can't imagine Linda's article disagrees with you about the dangers of allowing mulch to cover the bark of a tree.
Let's just directly quote her article. "Piling mulch against the trunks of shrubs and trees creates the dark, moist, low-oxygen environment that fungal diseases require to grow and reproduce. Piling mulch on the trunk provides exactly the right conditions for fungi to enter the plant. And opportunistic borers are more likely to invade a plant whose bark is wet due to excessive mulching. Rather than create mulch volcanoes, taper the mulch down to nearly nothing as you approach the trunk."
Which is almost exactly what you say, except that she forgot to add that it also makes a great hiding place for mice and voles to nibble away at the bark undetected. Is there any place in her article that you two actually disagree?
Yeah, she recommends mulching 4 to 6 inches deep. But she also specifies that that's just her personal opinion. The university research I've seen on mulches warns that anything deeper than 2 to 3 inches can prevent rainwater from getting through and cause oxygen deprivation at the root zone, especially in regions that get adequate rainfall.
What about the specific concerns of our listeners from South Carolina that the mulch will steal nitrogen from the soil and breed nuisance molds?
Okay, first the stealing of nitrogen. Tilling or otherwise mixing high carbon material like wood chips, leaves, or sawdust into the soil will tie up nitrogen, but it's generally not a serious problem when the material is on top of the soil. However, I do still think that they should add some coffee grounds or other high nitrogen material to their mulch after they thin it out and move it away from the trunks of those trees.
But you said that chips on the surface won't steal nitrogen.
They won't. But any wood mulch can breed house and car staining, artillery fungus, and other nuisance molds. Curiously, Linda doesn't mention this important problem in her article. But research conducted by one of my other favorite plant scientists, Dr. Harry Hointink of Ohio State University, found that keeping the mulch moist or mixing high nitrogen material like coffee grounds or composted manures into the chips can help prevent these fungal foes from developing.
Keeping it moist?
Yeah, how's that for counterintuitive? It seems that the moisture breeds bacteria that outcompete the bad fungal spores.
And that's from actual studies.
Yep, studies which also concluded, we must note, that compost makes the best mulch of all. Well, that sure was some great information about wood mulch, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to chip my arborist if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please include your location. Please tell us where you live.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website well mulched. Our non-volcanic intern is Alicia Lester. Arboristic Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our tree-hugging editor is Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And like my old idol, George Tirebiter, when it comes to talking about mulch, I never lie, and I'm always right. And I'll see you again next week.
Keeping rosemary alive furiously frustrates growers in cold climes. On the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, host Mike McGrath will reveal how to grow the fragrant herb in areas where ice storms are imminent. Plus, your fabulous phone calls.